This is RTE Radio 1, where it's time now for The Book Show.
Welcome to The Book Show with me, Sinead Gleeson. If you want to tweet us, we're at Bookshow RTE and on Facebook. On the show this evening, we're looking at sports writing. We talk to Christos Tchorzkis about Barracuda.
The first dive into the water made his heart leap. Stroke, kick, stroke, breathe, kick, stroke, kick, stroke, breathe, kick.
And talk about the classics in sports fiction.
The game doesn't change the way you sleep or wash your face or chew your food. It changes nothing but your life.
But first, Michael Moynihan is a sports journalist with the Irish Examiner and wrote GAA Economics, The Secret Life of Money in the GAA. I asked him why we always look to the US for the best writing about sports and why we're so influenced by the style there.
When you look at American sports books in particular, there seems to be much more of an appeal to a writer in the subjects. By that I mean kind of total immersion books. I mean, the big book for a long time was Friday Night Lights, which the TV series and movie were based on. The writer went to a little town in Texas, lived it for a year, watched how the team developed and how they broke up at the end of the high school year. And that became the template then for every Irish sports writer who was pitching an idea, you know, 1 year with this, 1 year on that. Then the template became Moneyball, in which you had statistics, you had a team, you had a bit of human interest, and that became the template, because it's hard to convey how I won't say indebted, but how influenced Irish sports writers are by American sports writing. For instance, in the Best American series, you know, the Best American Essays and Short Stories, etc., when the Best American Sports Writing annual comes out, it's almost as if every Irish sports journalist is trying to buy it before the next guy. You know, it's pre-ordered on Amazon months in advance. And there is that kind of orthodoxy that the best sports writing is American. The only issue with that is that obviously for reasons of economy of scale, you know, American publishing companies can publish really quirky, you know, focused books, which isn't a reality here. I would have lost count of the number of times pals of mine come back from New York and say, I was in the Strand and I picked up this book about how the stitching on baseball is counterclockwise and that explains, you know, the religious crisis in America, and you should write something like that. You should write a book like that about hurling. And you're saying, yeah, but I mean, you know, 3 in 4 people will buy it. A publisher once said to me about a lot of these American influenced ideals, say, I know every sports writer you know would buy that, but he said, that's not really a business model for me to be just publishing for sports writers.
But why do you think the American writing is better?
I suppose it's a numbers game. There's more of them, so there's more good guys, and the creme de la creme are really, really good. I mean, someone like Michael Lewis, who wrote Moneyball, must be, not just in sports, and probably one of the best non-fiction writers now in America across any genre you care to name. But even their columnists, because there are just so many of them, and it's so cutthroat there, that the very best guys who rise to the top, who sign for the New Yorker or Sports Illustrated, or even who do the occasional sports piece for Vanity Fair, because of, you know, natural selection, they just tend to be better. They get more time. You know, the great icon of Irish sports writing is Gary Smith of Sports Illustrated, who never starts a piece until he's done 50 interviews, which obviously is a world removed from the day-to-day, or even, you know, the people who write sports books in Ireland.
In terms of writing about the GAA, it seems to me that there hasn't been an awful lot written about it, or it was written in a very journalistic, columny way, but there weren't a lot of books about it. Why do you think it's taken a long time for it to filter into actual physical books?
On the one hand, I think maybe it's a publishing issue, that maybe, you know, publishers didn't feel they'd shift a lot of GAA books unless they had, you know, the once-in-a-lifetime superstar who would just transcend all genres. But nowadays, you do see, and maybe this is because there is a lot of smaller publishers who are more kind of bespoke, doing autobiographies of players, in some cases players who weren't household names but who have very good stories. There's also a natural reticence, I think, with the GAA, in the sense that, you know, there wouldn't be a tradition of players over the years putting themselves front and centre and saying, up to, I'd say, 10 years ago, you know, I should write a book. You know, I'm so important that I need to write a book. I think there was a leap of faith there with a lot of GAA players who had a great story to tell, not necessarily a sports story, but, you know, personal issues, etc. Donal Cusack's book about being so frank about his sexuality is the obvious example. And there are all sorts of similar stories within the GAA, but I suppose one issue, I mean, we're talking about Ireland, England, America, is that it's a very narrow focus. Obviously, someone like Jonathan Sexton publishes an autobiography, and that will sell a little bit in Wales, a little bit in Scotland, a little bit in England. But obviously, a GAA book is very circumscribed. And the thing that makes the GAA great is the intercountry rivalry. So there would be an argument that, you know, some counties would be congenitally disposed not to buy the book written by a hero from their rival county.
Well, we're talking, Michael, about sports writing, and when I think of maybe essays about sport or non-fiction or creative non-fiction about sport, do you think there's a sense that maybe it's looked down on a little, even though we have writers like, say, Paul Auster, who's written substantially about sport, baseball, football, everything?
I mean, you put your finger on it there. I would have interviewed Kevin Barry, you know, for instance, for the sports pages of The Examiner, just to try and get something different, and he would have made the point that it's a very natural thing in American fiction and even non-fiction. Someone like Philip Roth or John Updike would write about sport. Updike wrote probably the single greatest feature for The New Yorker about Ted Williams, and apparently wrote that against the clock on a deadline, which makes it even more impressive. But I suppose it's a wider question as to why that's a very natural thing to pick up an American novel and they're talking about the Red Sox, or they're talking about some, you know, a baseball team of some description, like in Underworld by Don DeLillo. That's just taken as read. But here it is quite unusual. I suppose the smart answer would be it's hard to imagine someone like John Banville or Cullum Tobin writing about, you know, the Wexford senior hurling team. And there are all sorts of reasons to do with, you know, the literary establishment, I suppose. But it is something that you would notice, not just with GA, but just with sport generally, that it doesn't seem to pop up when two characters are having a conversation about the rugby game, the hurling game, etc., that it just doesn't seem to figure.
We're talking about Irish writing being somewhat overshadowed by American sports writing, but what do you think would make the next great Irish sports book in terms of the writing?
I don't think there's been, for instance, a no-holds-barred autobiography in Irish sport. By that, I mean, the obvious example would be this baseball player, Jim Bouton, wrote this book, Ball 4, I think the late 60s, early 70s, which is very mild now. It was an autobiography, but he was honest about the players taking uppers to keep themselves going, about drinking a lot, cheating on their wives, you know, even passing comments on women in hotel lobbies, which really stripped the veil away from the kind of reverential, you know, that these guys were actual paragons of virtue off the field as well as on the field. And that hasn't happened yet in Irish sport. They're having kind of hints and glimpses of it, which is not to say that Irish sport is a kind of a Babylon of debauchery, but as I said earlier, that tone of kind of strained modesty all the time with sports autobiographies kind of precludes that. But I think what would happen there is that you would need a sports person to actually tell their own story, and a lot of them find that very difficult.
And thanks to Michael Moynihan, whose book, GAA Economics, The Secret Life of Money in the GAA, is published by Gill & Macmillan. So from non-fiction sports writing to fiction, why is it such a powerful backdrop for a novel? Perhaps this excerpt from Underworld by Don DeLillo gives some idea of the draw of the world of sport.
There's a 16-year-old in the Bronx who takes his radio up to the roof of his building so he can listen alone. A Dodger fan in the gloaming. And he hears the account of the misplaced bunt and the fly ball that scores the dying run. And he looks out over the rooftops, the tar beaches with their clotheslines and pigeon coops and splattered condoms, and he gets the cold creeps. The game doesn't change the way you sleep or wash your face or chew your food. It changes nothing but your life.
And that was a reading there by Will O'Connell from Underworld by Don DeLillo, considered, I think, by many to be one of the best modern pieces of sports fiction out there. With me now, our writer Sheila Flanagan. Not only is Sheila a writer, but she's connected to the world of sport as a director of the Irish Sports Council. And also with us is Jim Carroll of the Irish Times and organiser of the Banter series of talks. Sheila, what was your first introduction to writing about sports or reading about sport and fiction?
The first sports book that I read would have been Fever Pitch, which is not really it's not fiction. It's semi autobiographical, I suppose. And I'm sure that it was fictionalized in certain aspects of it. But I have to say that I thought it was a powerful piece of writing. I thought it was amazing. It engaged me. I was working at the time, I guess, with a group of guys, so it engaged me with the football and their interest in football in a way that maybe I hadn't had before. So It also was a great insight into how men express their emotions through sport. So I found that very powerful.
Well, all of us have read it, but if they hadn't, what is the story?
Well, it's about a guy's obsession with Arsenal Football Club. And I think at the time that he was writing it, Arsenal was going through a particularly dire period in its footballing prowess.
Certain Arsenal fans would probably argue that it was a similar dire period.
Well, that was going through my mind, actually, as I said. But in fairness, they aren't doing too badly. They may not have won anything, but they're not doing too badly. But, you know, it's basically, you know, maps out a season of Arsenal Football Club and the matches that he goes to. And he gives information about going into the matches and how up or how down he is, depending on how he thinks that they're going to go. And of course, every time they lose, he is utterly, utterly devastated. And it's you know, that whole essence of a sports fan and what it is to be a sports fan. And I think that's probably what's different about it, because it's not actually about the sports people itself. It's about being the participant as a fan.
Well, I want to ask you about that, but let's take a section from the novel where the main character gives us a sense of what it's actually like when you walk into one of those big Premiership stadiums.
But I do have other, more reliable and probably more meaningful memories. I remember the overwhelming maleness of it all. Cigar and pipe smoke, foul language, words I had heard before, but not from adults, not at that volume. And only years later did it occur to me that this was bound to have an effect on a boy who lived with his mother and his sister. And I remember looking at the crowd more than at the players. From where I was sitting, I could probably have counted 20,000 heads. Only the sports fan, or Mick Jagger, or Nelson Mandela, can do that. My father told me that there were nearly as many people in the stadium as lived in my town, and I was suitably awed.
And that was Will O'Connell reading there from Nick Hornby's Fever Pitch. Jim, to touch on what Sheila said there about the idea that it isn't just a book about Arsenal or about football, does a sports novel need that? Does it need something else going on outside of the actual sport itself?
I think it does, in order, I suppose, to kind of bring in a much broader audience. I mean, what Sheila said there is very interesting about, like, and also from that excerpt read by Will about the maleness as well. I mean, a lot of sports is seen as a very kind of male preserve, but, I mean, fiction wouldn't necessarily be seen by many people as either as a male thing. I mean, when males sports fans want to read about sports, they tend to go for the non-fiction books. They tend to go for the terrible ghost-written biographies, or they tend to go for, like, I mean, like a story like Fever Pitch that they can actually, I suppose, you know, they can associate themselves with and they can understand where it's coming from. I mean, I think one of the problems with fiction as well is that Michael Moynihan touched on this in his piece as well, is that, like, I mean, the best sports writing still in book form is coming from across the Atlantic, and, like, I mean, it's normally about baseball and it's about American football. There are sometimes, like, when they say, for example, there was a great book last year, the year before, by Ben Fountain called Billy Lenz's Long Halftime Walk, and that's about a returning Iraqi veteran. He basically sent on a tour of US sports grounds, and there's some great pieces in the book about the razzle dazzle of a Dallas Cowboys home game, you know, and all that goes with it, in the corporate boxes and the cheerleaders and so on. And, like, it's really, really good, but it's very much about the background. It's very much about, like, I mean, the ephemera as opposed to the action on the pitch. And it's a really good thing as well, because we were talking about this beforehand, Sheila. I mean, we don't really know that much about baseball or American football.
Yeah. I mean, there are all the kind of the dust and the people sitting on the bleachers, and there's the thing about the ball and the stitching of the ball and all that sort of stuff, which doesn't really resonate with me, I have to say. And so, you know, the great American sports novels don't really engage with me, or I don't engage with them, I have to say, in the same way as perhaps I would have done with something like Fever Pitch, or in the same way as I would do with a really good autobiography. And I do think that the thing about sports writing and sports in books is that the factual is so much more than the fictional, you know.
What Michael touched on, the idea of Moneyball being on about a team, and you're talking about Billy Lynn is about the ephemera, but do sports novels, are they guilty of falling into the tropes of, you know, the outsider story, the big winning team, the, you know, all of those kind of the cliches, the things where, you know, the triumph over adversity?
I think that novels are about triumph over adversity in a large degree, you know, and I guess that's the way the sports novel is going to go. And if, I suppose, if you know what it's going to be about from the start, maybe the sense of danger, the sense of investment that you have in it is less, you know. And I don't think that you can get the same grit from a sports novel about adversity as you can get from a good factual book, a non-fiction book about adversity in the sporting field.
I don't know. Do you agree, Jim?
Well, see, so sometimes, you know, that story of the loser and that story, like, I mean, it's often an awful lot better. I remember a great story that Tony Fletcher had in Jamming magazine years and years ago about a boxer who'd lost his fight, and the interview had been set up before the fight actually began, so he didn't realise the boxer was going to lose. And after the boxer had lost the fight, and sorry, I can't remember the name of the boxer, he was thinking this could be a very interesting story, because you're talking to someone who wasn't expected to. He wasn't expecting to lose, and also he had a lot better stories to tell as well. You know, I do agree though that, like, you know, you do sort of like know the, I suppose, the outcome in advance, because I mean, but the narrative when it comes to sports is triumph over adversity. It's snatching victory from the jaws of defeat. It's like someone like, you know, it's someone like Alex Ferguson or Wayne Rooney from the, like, I mean, the wrong side of the track, so to speak. You know, and how they kind of get to a situation where they're in control of a club like Manchester United, or able to earn £300,000 sterling a week for running around the pitch.
So what do you think are the greatest depictions of sport in novels? And again, you don't have to be a sports fan to read a great book about sport.
I think one of the best depictions of sports in any novel is Quidditch in the Harry Potter series, because the energy of this game is incredible. I remember it stopping me in my tracks, and I remember when I went to the movie as well, it was one of the things I was looking out for. Could they capture this on screen? And they did as well. That's my mind's definitely one of them.
Yeah, I'm struggling to find a good depiction of sport as such, like that with Quidditch. But I have to say that my favourite sports stories are actually by P.G. Wodehouse, who did a compendium of short stories all about golf, which is called, I don't know, The Art of Golf or something like that. And it's all about people who are really hopeless at golf. And it encapsulates the drive to want to play the perfect round. I think P.G. Wodehouse started the book with a foreword in which he said that, you know, for him, a great golfing day was to break 96. And that was way better for him than it ever would be for Jack Nicklaus, who, if he hit a 96, would go home and never come out again, you know. And so I think sports novels can't always be about the triumph over adversity or the redemption through a sport. You know, they have to have other sides to them.
I think another one would definitely be David Peace's two books on football. I mean, The Damned United about Brian Clough. I mean, Brian Clough's very short-term reign at Leeds United. It's a fantastic piece of work, brilliant piece of work. Then again, there was his recent book on Bill Shankly. And I'm a Liverpool fan true and true. I found it really hard going because, I mean, it was 700 pages long. It's every single detail of Shankly's life repeated over and over and over again. I think a lot of people found it hard going. Those who stuck with it, and many Liverpool fans kind of found it really enjoyable. But I kept going back to The Damned United. That's a superb piece of writing.
Roddy Doyle's written about football, so is Dermot Bulger, but how have Irish writers fared when it comes to writing about sport?
It's very interesting because by and by they've stuck to the big sports. I mean, for example, there's been no GAA novel, you know, there's been no kind of like novel about a East Limerick junior hurling team, you know. In non-fiction there has been, like, I mean, Michael referenced, like, people kind of spending a year with a club, and that's definitely been a book by Christy O'Connor called The Club, but that came out of that. But, like, sometimes I kind of wonder that with GAA particularly, that you can't really better some of the real characters out there. Can you really better someone like Paul Galvin, who up to recently was playing inter-county football for Kerry as well as kind of being a fashionista? Can you better the O'Halpin brothers who arrived from Fiji to play hurling for Cork? You know, can you actually rival stories like sticking a referee in the boot of a car in Wicklow? You know, sometimes the real life stories are better than anything fiction can throw at you. I mean, some Irish writers though have handled kind of, like, I suppose, sports well. I mean, for example, Joseph O'Neill, like the Irish writer in New York, his book Netherland is a fantastic piece of writing, and that's based around cricket.
Let's have a listen to Will O'Connell reading from Netherland by Joseph O'Neill, and this is where the main character, Hans van der Broek, sits at a computer and uses Google Earth to zoom over the old cricket field and finds that it has browned.
There's Chuck's field. It is brown. The grass has burned. But it is still there. There's no trace of a batting square. The equipment shed is gone. I'm just seeing a field. I stare at it for a while. I am contending with a variety of reactions, and consequently with a single brush on the touchpad I flee upward into the atmosphere and at once have in my sights the physical planet, submarine wrinkles and all, have the option, if so moved, to go anywhere. From up here, though, a human's movement is a barely intelligible thing. Where would he move to, and for what? There is no sign of nations. No sense of the work of man. The USA, as such, is nowhere to be seen.
And it was Will O'Connell reading there from Joseph O'Neill's Netherland. Sheila, Jim mentioned the idea of the truth stranger than fiction. Is that why maybe you're less of a sports fan than Jim is in terms of fiction?
Certainly in terms of fiction, yeah. I don't think that fiction actually does manage to capture what happens in fact. And I guess when I'm reading sports books, I'm more inclined to go for the biographies than anything else, or the season of something or other, you know.
I think I'm still holding out for what Michael Moynihan suggested, that Donal Ryan should write the next great Irish hurling novel, which I would definitely read. And thanks so much to Sheila and Jim. Sheila O'Flanagan's novel, Things We Never Say, will be published in April. And Jim Carroll is running a sports discussion festival, The Back Page, in Dublin from March 27th to 29th. Now, Christos Choilskas has followed up his 2008 novel, The Slap, with Barracuda, which looks at the life of an ambitious young swimmer and how he deals with failure. Choilskas spoke to us about the main character, Danny Kelly.
He's a working class lad from Melbourne. He's his father's Scots Irish background, his mother is Greek. He has a phenomenal talent and ability at swimming, and he gets a scholarship at an elite private school. And Barracuda is the nickname he gets at that school because he feels like he has to prove himself over and over again. He feels that he is an outsider in so many ways at this kind of school, this kind of environment. And Barracuda is a vicious, dangerous fish that you don't want to be in the water with.
Competition and competitiveness feature very strongly in the book, as they would do in any book about sport. But it's very linked, I think, in this stage because you're dealing with lots of young men and there's a lot of testosterone and there's a lot of emotion around them. It's an old concept, competitiveness and being, you know, aspirational. Why write about that and why do it through the medium of sport?
The notion of competition and the notion of success had been playing on my mind after the success of The Slap. I don't know what language I can use on the program, but we've got, you know, the phrase, the pissing contest in Australia, you know. That I wanted to explore that as well. I wanted to explore what it meant to feel this weight in your life. I wanted to explore aggression again, which I had been doing from my first book, from a book called Loaded, where the young man is so full of rage, is so aggressive in his thoughts. It's all interior monologue. In a strange way, the success of The Slap led me back to those origins, but now I was looking at him as a man in his middle age. So I was able to see competition, I was able to see aggression, I was able to see rage in a different way, and one of those different ways was to say that you can tame it, that you can live with it, that you can learn how to deal with it. Sports proved a very good metaphor to look at masculinity.
There is a sense when we see Danny Kelly, the barracuda, he's been shaved by his mother to sort of to make him more aerodynamic in the water, but he's at the same time he's watching television and he's looking at his heroes on television, and it's a sense that identity and success are very much linked, as they are to fame. And yet when you look at sport, you know, if you're a writer, you're sitting in a room, it's a comfortable life. If you're an actor, you get to go to ceremonies. If you're a sports star, you're in the pool for 8 hours a day. There's an awful lot of boredom and repetition.
Unlike being a writer.
Not unlike being a writer. But there's an awful lot more work goes into being a sports star than possibly, you know, a lot of more invisible work, if you like, than, say, being an actor or being a writer. There is that very physical graft.
I think that's one of the things that that really attracted me to trying to understand a sports person, because I wasn't that kind of child. I wasn't that kind of adolescent. I didn't have that discipline. So there is something fascinating about trying to understand where that will comes from. I think there must be something, almost a cousin of that will, in making a choice to be an artist or a writer, because you need an incredible self-belief to really sustain yourself. And because I'm not a sports person, because I don't know where that will comes from, but I know where the will to write comes from. I wondered if by writing a novel about this swimmer, it would make sense of something about my desire to write. Where does that come from?
That sense of the body that you talk about, that really comes across in the book. There's a very physical sense, the physicality of him, the work, the strenuousness, the exertion of it. You might read a section from the book Barracuda for us, Christos.
The first dive into the water made his heart leap. Stroke, kick, stroke, breathe, kick, stroke, kick, stroke, breathe, kick. He slammed down the pool, the water slipping past him, cradling him, holding him. Stroke, kick, stroke, breathe, kick. He touched the tiles and effortlessly propelled himself back down the lane. There was a man in front of him and Danny had to slow his pace. He needed a lane to himself. Stroke, kick, stroke, breathe, kick. There was a slight pull on his side every time he raised his left arm, a dull tension, and he guessed that one of Tsitsis's punches must have bruised his ribs. It wasn't painful, but he couldn't shake his awareness of it. It kept pace with him and the water, and he wished he was at training. The coach would know exactly what he should do. He lessened the force of his stroke, maintaining the power of his kick and slowing his breathing, and minutely reduced his pace. The man in front was resting against the tiles, allowing Danny to cut in front. Giving the man a nod as he entered his turn, Danny kicked off. But in overcompensating for his injury, he rolled to his right side and reeled clumsily, rising for breath off kilter, all his weight on his left. Stroke, kick, he balanced himself, felt the water holding him. Stroke, kick, stroke, breath, kick.
And that was Christos Schoelkes reading from Barracuda. There are challenges of writing that very physical, kinetic world.
It was a real challenge. I read so many swimming biographies and autobiographies, and my God, they are so boring. and it was really interesting that I actually didn't glean very much from that work at all. And I interviewed people who were swimming now competitively. The one I really wanted to speak to was Daniel Kowalski. Daniel Kowalski was an excellent, terrific Australian swimmer in the 90s. In the Atlanta Olympics, he swam alongside Kieran Perkins. And the Kieran Perkins came from behind and actually, in a way you could say, stole the medal. The other reason I wanted to talk to Kowalski is that he publicly came out as a gay man, you know, a few years before I started writing the book. And I thought it would be interesting to talk to someone because, you know, Danny is a gay man, he's homosexual, that I thought it would be interesting to talk to someone who'd had that experience as well, just to see if I get it right, you know, or just... I was going to say, in terms of the... It was really interesting. In terms of the actual, how does the body work in the water? What does it mean to be in the pool? Even in the interviews, it was almost that they couldn't describe it to me. They could not talk to me about that. They could give me little details about what happens afterwards and what... However, in terms of the moment in the pool, to a woman and to a man, it was as if they were saying, I'm in a zone where I can't tell you what the body does. And so in the end, I had to use my imagination to actually... The moments of Danny in the water are mine. I got a lot of gifts from those interviews, but in terms of having to work out a language that will give you, as a reader, a sense of the will, a sense of the discipline, a sense of that God awful long time that you have to be in the water, I had to find it in the writing. I had to keep working on that one.
And that was Christos Schoelkes there. Barracuda, his novel, is published by Atlantic Books. That brings us to the end of another show. The readings tonight were by Will O'Connell, Noel Roberts was on sound, and the book show is produced by Zoe Cummins and available to listen back on iTunes and on rte.ie. This evening's footnote by Regan Hutchins looks at the sporting career Tom Wolfe might have had. Tune in next Saturday at 7 p.m.
Life's a pitch for the professional baseball player, but it wasn't to be for college team star Tom Wolfe. The author of Bonfire of the Vanities and the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test dreamed of transferring his amateur playing field success onto the professional league. So in 1952, he showed up for tryouts with the New York Giants and by all accounts did well, just not well enough. After 2 days, he was shown the turnstile and embarked instead on a long and often controversial writing career. For Wolfe was quite the champ in the field of literary feuds, sparring publicly with Norman Mailer, John Updike and John Irving, who said reading Wolfe was like reading a bad newspaper. Of those four giants of 20th century literature, Wolfe is the last man standing, which in baseball might be termed a good hitting streak.
The book show is presented by Sinead Gleeson.